Live from the Talking Joe Studios, it's Talking Joe.
G.I. Joe, the very best, America's elite. Eliter than all the rest, trained to have no flaws. Defending liberty across the land, valor oversized. Bring out that big brass band, real heroes verified.
G.I. Joe!
Gotta read them all, you must agree. Elitist in history,
G.I. Joe.
Oh, there could be no end in a world we must defend.
G.I. Joe,
gotta read them. A courageous crew. Their colors red, white, and blue. Mess with them and they'll shoot you. G.I. Joe, gotta read them all. Gotta read them all.
Hey, 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 it's me, Mark, and welcome to Talking Joe, the G.I. Joe Comics Podcast. If you're new to the show, you can find out all of the details about us over at the website, which is talkingjoe.co.uk. We are continuing our look at the Disavowed era as General Ray's mysterious secrets are revealed in G.I. Joe America's Elite issues 19 to 20 from Devil's Due back in January and February 2007. This is a two-parter called Emperor's New Clothes, written by editor Mike O'Sullivan. For those reading along in trades, this is collected in the 2007 America's Elite Trade Paperback Volume 4, Truth and Consequences from Devil's Due, or 2014's trade paperback America's Elite Volume 4 from IDW, which also reprints 19 through 24. Now, without any further ado, here is my co-host. It's a real American cloned military leader from the past. It's Tim Finn.
Hello, listeners, and hello, Mark.
Napoleon.
I was sort of lost in thought then for a mini second, just thinking about the name of this two-parter, Emperor's New Clothes, and the layers of meaning.
So for those of us who don't know that original story, tell us about this.
Well, essentially, it's a fairy tale, isn't it? Or sort of one of these folk tales about an emperor who is very vain, and he wants the fanciest set of new clothes, and he gets these tailors to come in. They stitch him an outfit which they say is the very best, most amazing suit, but it's invisible. And they say something like, but you have to be very clever to see it, and something like that. So he doesn't want to admit that he's not very clever. So he says, oh yes, this is obviously the finest suit ever. And he goes on a parade, and everyone goes along with the charade. They don't want to be the one to put up their hand and say the emperor has got no clothes on, except for one little boy who has got the bravery and the sort of insight of a child and willing to speak their mind and says, the emperor's not got no clothes on. And then everything falls apart for the tailors, and the veil is revealed. That's about right, isn't it, Tim?
I was just thinking of Disney's animated feature film, Empire of the Sun, which was never finished, and it was turned into and reworked as The Emperor's New Groove, which was a uncharacteristic Disney animated film. So I'm trying to think of a joke, a G.I. Joe joke I can make where I cross something about this, it's coming to me.
I'll just add that the story The Emperor's New Clothes is originally credited to Hans Christian Andersen, also famous. It was published alongside The Little Mermaid.
Here's the joke. My joke has coalesced in an animated version of this story arc from America's Elite. The voice of General Ray can be portrayed by the actor David Spade. Thank you. Thank you. Yes, thank you.
Was he in The Emperor's New Groove? Is that the...
Yes.
Okay. Did you describe this thing that you said as a joke?
That was the joke.
Okay, right, okay. So yeah, I guess the parallels are is you know, he's an emperor, he's Serpentor, the emperor, he's got and he's got new clothes on, he's not wearing a gold suit thing, he's dressed as General Ray, but also he's naked at the same time for some reason. There's probably a metaphor there that you can kind of eke out, but I don't know if I'm going to be able to. Shall we talk about the creative team?
Yeah.
So this comes to you from writer/editor Mike O'Sullivan. Pencils, Tim Seeley with Javier Sicilia. Inkers, Robert Q. Atkins and Nick Nix. Colorist, Chris Summers. Letters, Brian J. Crowley. Military advisor, Phil Kost. And we have a special thanks on 19 to Brian J. Crowley and Tim Straub for Art Assists, and on 20 for Dan Counselor Billings and Brian Beeney Tawney.
Yes, that special thanks in 20 isn't more specific, so we're not sure if that's story or consulting or color or art.
Could be anything. Could be anything.
do you have any guesses in 19? Where Brian J. Crowley and or Tim Straub might be assisting with the art? Does anything jump out at you as looking a little different?
Yeah, as I was flicking it through, there were a couple of places where I thought to myself, it looks a little bit different. So like when they're in the High Sierras, it doesn't quite look like the same Tim Seeley, Robert Atkins art is in the previous pages, and like eyebrows are somewhat intense in terms of their magnitude.
Yeah, you know what? Having not seen Javier, I'm gonna pronounce his last name differently. This is just a guess. Javier Sicilia's, having not seen his art before this,
differently. Some people might say more accurately.
we neither of us are sure. Having not seen his art before, I'm not sure sort of where his art from one page to the next might be different, might have had work done by someone else. But I think you're right. Something about some of these Tim Seeley faces seem a little different from Tim Seeley, but they look nice. So if that is the art assist, I think it was a good one. And since this two-part story falls after a marquee writer finished up his 19-issue run, and before a new writer takes over with a big deal four-part story, and since this two-parter, 19 and 20, that we're talking about today, are split in half, some pages drawn and colored by one team, and the other pages drawn and then colored by the same person, drawn by a different team, I do think
we can put a pin in that, actually, that most of the pages are either drawn by Tim Seeley with Robert Q. Atkins, or Javier Sicilia and Nick Nix. Nick Nix.
Yes. What I mean is, this is often the kind of arrangement that an editor has when a book is falling behind schedule, mm-hmm. yeah. or needs to get ahead of schedule. You know, you can't wait for Seeley or Sicilia to draw the whole issue, so you have them both draw on the issue at the same time, so you can get it done hopefully in half the time. So, you know, maybe these two issues were drawn and approved in the time it would take, you know, one issue to get drawn and approved, so that they could, you know, make sure that the next story has a little extra time for that team to sort of get into its groove. Up into its new clothes.
And the likelihood being that Tim Seeley is the kind of in-house staff artist who is known for being quick is probably the person called on to help with that speed element. Perhaps Javier Sicilia was meant to do the whole thing, but it was just too tight of pressure. Or maybe yeah. they just knew into it, went into it knowing that there was simply not enough time. And
also... it. Worth pointing out, at the same time that these issues are getting worked on, Seeley is writing the fourth G.I. Joe Transformers crossover for Devil's Due, which is two double-sized issues. And writing comics takes less time than drawing comics. But, you know, it's not like Seeley was, you know, this wasn't the only thing he was doing at the time. Drawing half of G.I. Joe, America's Elite 19 and 20.
Cool. Let's have a look at the covers, shall we?
Yes.
Let's have a look at the covers in the gallery.
The cover to 19 is Tim Seeley, Robert Q. Atkins, and Jason Jensen. There are three characters on the cover. In the foreground, in profile, waist up, are Duke and General Ray sort of arguing, grappling with each other in profile. And behind them, taking up two-thirds of the cover, is the face of Serpentor, including his full headgear with the fangs and, you know, the cowl. The two characters in the foreground are drawn and inked and colored in a normal way, and Serpentor in the background is pencils only, not inked, and then rendered a little bit more like paint and a little less like sort of, quote, regular comics color. This reminds me a little bit of the Marvel Flare trading cards, where, what was in the 90s, Marvel did this for a year or two, where Marvel had some previously published artwork recolored, like fully digitally painted. So there's a bit of a softness to this Serpentor head behind them. And he's looking directly at you, at me, the reader. He's not looking at Duke or Ray. His pupils are pretty skinny, looking somewhat serpentine. And who was it who told us that on this cover, Duke had been holding a weapon and Hasbro?
It was, yeah, Sam Wells talking about Hasbro's editorial notes on having weapons on the covers.
Right. Thank you. Sam Wells, who in these two issues is the credited assistant publisher. And I got to say, considering how, you know, occasionally undramatic G.I. Joe covers are when there are no weapons, I wouldn't say that this cover to 19 lost a lot for having its weapon removed. It's still in a lot of the tension between these characters is still there. And then the cover to 20 is Serpentor in the foreground, but it's actually General Ray. So it's General Ray from chin up, but he's wearing all of Serpentor's costuming. And we're seeing him from behind, and he's cropped on the left side, and we're seeing him sort of mid-thigh up, and he's turning to look not at us, but a little bit sort of past the camera on the right. He's taken the cowl off. He's holding it in his right hand with his arm somewhat outstretched. And then in the background behind him are five basic Cobra soldiers in blue, and they are looking at him. Looks like three of them are Caucasian and two of them are African American. I always appreciate a little variety in the population of Cobra soldiers or Cobra officers. And the background colors here are sort of a pink brown that grades up to almost black on the top. And from off camera on the left, Serpentor General Ray is underlit with a red. Interestingly, this cover, which is Tim Seeley and Robert Q. Atkins, was colored by Stefan Peru, who died at the age of 26 and had been coloring for DC and Marvel and a European publisher, Soleil. He died in 2008. So a year and a half after this comic was published. I don't know that his name pops up a lot in G.I. Joe. So that's this cover at issue 20.
Very good, Tim. So last time we spoke, the Joes had fought off an invasion of their rock base with General Ray left in tatters after realizing that he had been on the wrong side. So let's have a plot breakdown and find out the gist of what happens in this issue.
Plot breakdown.
At The Rock, General Colton, leads a memorial service to the 37 lost staff members as the Joes are sent on leave for some rest. General Philip Ray asks Duke to help him discover information about his past. They follow a lead which takes them to Xandar, who is with Zartan and the Dreadnoks in the Florida Everglades. After a fight, Xandar explains that he brokered a deal between Mindbender and the Jugglers. He made a big delivery, but the person to talk to is actually Ray's psychologist, a Dr. Stevens. Duke and Ray confront Dr. Stevens. Stevens explains Ray's backstory. When Mindbender created the first Serpentor, another clone was also artificially aged. Xandar brokered the sale of the altered synthetic to General Gibbs of the Jugglers. Eventually, the Jugglers gave him the name Philip Ray and assigned him to lead the G.I. Joe team. Crystal Ball, using the Dr. Stevens identity, became Ray's psychologist. He used post-hypnotic triggers to activate Ray and use him to attack the Joes at the Rock. Back in the present, Crystal Ball asks Ray to kill Duke so he can truly become Serpentor. Ray looks at Duke but breaks his hypnotic trigger and knocks out Crystal Ball. Duke decides to give Ray another chance. Ray responds, "I won't let you down." So, Tim, where would you like to start?
I would like to start with... Okay, so in a general sense, let's talk about this as a two-parter, which is both an epilogue for the 19 issues just prior, written by Joe Casey, as well as an epilogue for the Brandon Drewa run, because there are so many references in these two issues, 19 and 20, to what happened with Xandar, with Dr. Mindbender, with Serpentor, with Cobra Commander, with the Red Shadows, and even to some extent, with Colton sending the Joes on 4 days R&R in these two issues, we sort of even get sort of a check back in with moments from the early Blaylock issues at the beginning of the previous series, where we see the Joes living their civilian lives or living their sort of non-active duty lives with family. So I wanted to say that writer Mike O'Sullivan here helped tie up a couple ideas. I don't want to say loose ends, but ideas for me. He gave me closure on a couple items which I had wanted from the Jurwa run and which I had wanted in the, or maybe a better explanation for, in the Joe Casey run. So as a now longtime reader of this series, I really appreciated the work being done in these two issues. At the same time, and I have an example in a minute, at the same time, I don't know that these two issues are going to pull in any new readers. And if you're a big Joe Casey fan, you might be really feeling the loss, you know, even though he goes out on his own terms after, you know, with his final issue. But these two issues feel very much like, both in a good way and maybe a bad way, a writer looking back at the previous 20 issues and 40 issues and saying, you know, I need to explain a couple things for readers. And I think Mike O'Sullivan can do that because as editor, he's been paying attention.
Yeah.
And maybe he or someone feels like it needs to be done. And so as a longtime reader, several times while reading these two issues, I thought, yeah, good, thanks. But I also thought, that these two issues reminded me a little bit of some of these like epilogue issues in like a Marvel event, you know, like World War Hulk or Secret Invasion or, you know, Civil War II. You read some Marvel event where there's a main miniseries that's, you know, 5 or 10 issues where all the big stuff is happening. And then a bunch of the other ongoing series are crossing over. And it's what like other characters are doing during that story, or additional information scenes are sort of expanded, or key flashbacks that set up the big event. And then there'll be some special, you know, like like Greg Pak is writing World War Hulk, and I can't remember if Greg Pak or Peter David is writing the then concurrent issues of Incredible Hulk, but the big stuff can't happen in Incredible Hulk because the big stuff has to happen in World War Hulk. But those five or six issues of the regular Incredible Hulk are going to get collected in their own book. And that has to be a satisfying read. So Marvel's going to do some like prologue special and some epilogue special that can make the like World War Hulk tie-in collection of those issues of Incredible Hulk be a satisfying read. So it's not just some side mission that takes place during the big event. And you get to that epilogue, and oftentimes that epilogue explains something that was missing from the last 6 months of the big events and the side events. Maybe I'm getting too inside baseball here. So before I give you my example, let me just pass the mic back to you, Mark, about these two issues top down.
Yeah, I think, like as you say, it's very much sort of looking back at what's come before and tying a knot in it. And it's quite sort of noticeable that you don't, in a normal Joe book, you don't get too many sort of editor call out boxes, you know, referring back to like previous issues or previous stories. And here you get it quite a lot, but potentially even multiple times on one page. It'll be, you know, a little asterisk to a dialogue box, CGI Joe Union of the Snake trade paperback. The next box has got, again, CGI Joe Rise of the Red Shadows trade paperback. There's quite a lot of these dotted about, and as you say, it's from Mike Sullivan being very familiar with the Miss material, editing a lot of it as well, and really sort of trying to tie back and reference an awful lot of it all in two issues. I sort of, in my plot breakdown, I kind of focused on the kind of the A story, but there's touching in with all of the sort of the individual Joes on their leave and sort of nudging their story forward or sort of looking back and going, yeah, remember, think about their sort of domestic setup and their friends and family and stuff, and let's sort of touch in with them a little bit. We've also got Tim Seeley on art as well, and that helps, I guess, with that same element of it sort of putting in mind slightly looking back, because he did so much of the Brandon Gerwer era and even before, that by having him as the artist, it sort of does help with that kind of aspect of looking back and sort of putting a bit of a cap on that story. It does feel a little bit in parts like an edited story, a highly edited story, in terms of all of the little moving pieces touching base on all of them, having it sort of work together very neatly and sort of tying in with everything that's come before, but not necessarily being a massively compelling story in its own right.
Yeah. So on the first page of this two-part story, in the second panel, Colton has a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 word balloon monologue, and it continues for three more word balloons in the next paragraph panel. And what he says here is both very reassuring to me as a reader, because he explains a couple of things that didn't quite work for me in the previous arc, things that I think Joe Casey either sort of filed the edges on. So in a previous episode, I said, I'm not sure that these five Cobra agents would work together on this mission as Phoenix Guard. One of them is a Dreadnought. One's a pilot. One's a mercenary, but he's also a ninja. And okay, Joe Casey drops the ninja thing. One is basically a Mars inventor for, it's not clear, Destro or Cobra. And one drives a boat. And so Michael Sullivan has Colton here say, we know that they disguise themselves using tech developed by Zartan in order to, say, change their voices. We can safely assume Zarana was the supplier of the tech, and the one that coached the others in their disguises. And so part of me, I've made this point twice already, but I can be specific here. Part of me thinks, oh, that's a really clever explanation for sort of the machinery of Phoenix Guard making sense in the story. Okay, Zarana did this. That's how they did this. And then it continues. But we are unsure if she was operating alone or as a part of the Dreadnoks. That's a great question. And that can motivate the story, you know, if they find her, if they somehow interact with the rest of the Dreadnoks. And then he continues. Why some of these dirtbags were working with Cobra again is unknown. Okay, and that goes back to where all those characters were at the end of the Brandon Jurawa run. I don't remember specifically where each of them was, but I did get the general sense during the Phoenix Guard story that Joe Casey was, like, he had a proper sort of excuse for Cobra Commander to be gone for a long time, so that when Cobra Commander showed up, it was a big deal, and the stakes were high because he'd been gone so long. He managed to infiltrate the White House, whereas, you know, where did Brandon Jurawa leave, say, Wild Weasel? I don't know if, you know, when we last saw him, there's enough sort of space for Joe Casey to then say, okay, over 10 issues, off panel, he's going to become a disguised fake G.I. Joe, right? Okay, and then Colton continues here. Again, this is the first page of issue 19. No doubt a huge paycheck and a shot at us was all they needed to sign on. Okay, so in the span of 5 word balloons, Mike O'Sullivan has just, he hasn't fixed a plot hole. Hole is too strong, but he has explained something that I don't think Joe Casey explained enough. And I don't know if Joe Casey knew that he was missing something and said, like, oh, let's just run with it. Or previously editor Mike O'Sullivan said, you know, you really need to explain this more. I'm not sure these 5 characters would work together. Or Joe Casey said, I'll get to it eventually. Or the next writer can get to it eventually. So on the one hand, I think, oh, thank you, Mike O'Sullivan, for making a thing make sense that didn't quite make sense. And on the other hand, I think it's a little conspicuous when there's this catch-up dialogue, this sort of Band-Aid dialogue. And that's why I'm referring to, you know, like a Brian Michael Bendis Avengers epilogue issue, some special after some big Marvel event 3 years ago, 5 years ago, 15 years ago, where it's like, okay, the Wasp is back from the dead because she wasn't really dead. She just shrunk and she was like stuck in the grass in Central Park during Secret Invasion or something. And we found her, and this is why we didn't know that she was actually there this whole time. Like, oh, so we have to tell her about all the like crossovers that she missed while she was dead, but she wasn't really dead. So we're going to do a couple splash pages in this Avengers epilogue issue where we can get past artists to come back and each do a couple pages, which is like this greatest hits album of like, oh man, Jan, you missed World War Hulk. Like, what was that? Like, oh, it's crazy. Sorry, I might be getting too deep into my Marvel comparison here, but
you're losing it a bit, Tim.
these 2 issues are epilogues, Emperor's New Clothes, and if you were puzzled or unsatisfied by the General Ray stuff, if you wanted more out of the Red Shadows, if some of the Joe Casey stuff, you know, I mean, the stuff in the Joe Casey run where Snake Eyes purges his ninja side so he's just a commando. You know, there's a 2-page scene here, maybe it's 3 pages, where Kamakura says to Snake Eyes, I'm not sure about that. And I thought, yeah, I'm not sure about that. And, you know, all of the long-running series in comics, I have more Marvel examples than DC examples, but there are many examples where a writer has a main book for a long time and they do something that people don't like, or they don't get to explain it, or they set up something, and then they're not writing the book some years later. And then another writer later on makes up their own explanation, gets around to doing the reveal or the change that the earlier writer never got to, but of course does it a little differently because they're not the same person, or decidedly contradicts something from a previous run because this later writer doesn't like it, or the editor wants them to. And I don't know if Mike O'Sullivan, you know, agreed with everything Joe Casey did. But as I read these two issues, I thought, is some of this Mike O'Sullivan smoothing some things over for the reader? Or is Mike O'Sullivan like very specifically fixing things from the Joe Casey run or the Brandon Jurowell run that didn't work? Because that two-page scene with Kamakura saying, I don't know about being just a commando, you know, strikes me a little bit as Mike O'Sullivan laying some track for the next writer to say, yeah, Snake Eyes is a ninja again.
Yeah. Yeah, he can still do ninja. Not like you just go in a sauna and sweat out your ninja. It's, I don't know.
It's a variant cover. It's Snake Eyes just with his mask and wearing a towel in a sauna. And next to him is Zartan just with his face makeup and his cowl, also wearing a towel, but like holding a dagger, threatening. Anyway.
I did look at that Snake Eyes scene and Kamakura there in his orange hoodie with his orange hair, with an orange sunset, thinking to myself, there's an awful lot of orange there.
When I saw that scene, I thought, there's one panel of Kamakura talking, and it's a close-up on his face, and the top of the panel is cropped at his forehead, so you don't see any of his hair. And I thought, wait, is Satin or Chabang talking now? Because this guy looks bald. And I know this is a me thing. Uh-huh. This is not a Tim Seeley problem. But you do sometimes have that unintended effect if you have someone with hair, if you crop in really close, whether conspicuously or accidentally, just past their sideburns and their, lowest bit of forehead hair, of sort of visually presenting them as someone with no hair on their head.
Yeah, earlier when I was describing this, I unintentionally called Kamakura Duke when I was describing his big, thick eyebrows. And I didn't make that mistake as I was reading it, but just sort of recapping it, flicking through the issue, I did, and I thought to myself back when I was reading it, if they didn't stick him in an orange hoodie, but instead it was like a sort of a more of a bright green, closer to the color of the Kamakura outfit, it's just one of those nice little visual clues help ease the reader along and make you realize who this guy is actually supposed to be.
Yeah, absolutely. When this is a general preference, if not rule of mine, unless a character has a scar or unique hair like Thrasher or Zartan or face makeup, Zartan version 2, makeup like Zartan version 1. I think generally artists and colorists, when characters are out of costume, you know, there's this convention that Clark Kent wears a blue suit with a red tie and Bruce Wayne wears a dark gray suit, a black suit, a dark blue suit, you know, with like a dark gray, like turtleneck under it with no tie, that not only do these two characters have a different sense of fashion, but you're sort of hinting, cheating's not the right word, but you're hinting with the color. Like, no, that's Superman. That's the guy who's Superman. And in real life, Clark Kent would not do that because he doesn't want anyone to look at him and think, that guy has colors like Superman. Well, he's tall like Superman. And Superman's not around. But for us as readers, this is part of the iconic thing. It's fun. And as Mark just said, it's helpful. So, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you can go a step further. Give Kamakura a hoodie where everything from the shoulders down is green and the hoodie part is purple. And then he's just sort of wearing the hoodie version of his costume. Make it easy on us. All right, page 2 of this first issue, Colton has remarks about the heavy losses that the Pit took in the previous storyline. And over 4 panels, there's a list of names behind him. And it's a list of support staff, 37 people. And it is in that sort of tech font that we've seen for the data desk, both on the inside front covers and the profiles at the backs of the issues. And on the one hand, I thought, good, Mike O'Sullivan is having Colton acknowledge that this previous incursion was costly. On the other hand, I see a list of names and I immediately wonder, are those Easter eggs? Which sort of distracts me a little bit. Like, oh, are those Devil's Due employees? Are these readers who won a contest? Are any of these Joe names by accident? And then I also thought, oh, wait a minute, I don't know who these support staff are. And the mean way of saying it is, I don't care. Or the neutral way of saying it is, well, support staff are never a big part of a G.I. Joe story, and we haven't gotten to know them. So in terms of the mechanics of writing, should Colton call this out? Yes. Is having a list of names reasonable? Yes. Is having the list of names across four panels, even if it's a background, does it run a risk of being a little distracting? Yeah, because I got a little distracted by it. I was thinking about it. And, you know, also the scenes in the previous issue, not to relitigate the previous issue, but the scenes where Phoenix Guard are taking out some of those support staff, not all those scenes were like the clearest. And it's not like there was one scene where one support staff, even though we never quite learn his code name or her code name, you know, where one of them like pushes Shipwreck out of the way in that hallway with no cover and like grabs a grenade and runs toward the Phoenix Guard and sacrifices himself. Like, no, they just all got killed. So that's what I think of that scene.
I did Google one of those names, Patrick Richard Bergvik, just because it was very unique looking name. And there is a person called that out there. I couldn't see any link to G.I. Joe. I could see Sean Murphy, who was linked to Devil's Due, the artist Sean Gordon Murphy, who went on to do the Storm Shadow covers. So I think he was doing bits and pieces with Devil's Due around about this era. So, I suspect that, as you say, there probably are some Easter eggs within that list.
But, you know, sometimes writers just grab the phone book. I mean, nowadays you would just Google. So then on page 3, the art changes, and, you know, there are different ways. If you are editor, you can have multiple artists split up an issue. Sometimes it's first half, second half. Sometimes it's all of the scenes with one character or set of characters and all the scenes with, in this case, Ray and Duke. And that's nice for consistency. There is a big difference. Seeley's art is more, this is an imprecise term, comic booky. It's a little bit more animation influenced, a little bit more cartoony. Cecilia's art is a little more realistic in his anatomy. His acting, right? This first page with Ray, I have recently heard a good argument that comic books don't need to follow the 180 degree rule because comic books are not film. I'm a little old fashioned. I think generally comic books should follow the 180-degree rule. And here on this page with the title, All the King's Horses, which I note is not the title from the cover, The Emperor's New Clothes.
No, and part two is All of the King's Men, All the King's Men.
Okay. So the story has a title and then subtitles. All right, so this first page by this other artist with Ray, there's a half page splash of Ray looking down and talking, and then there's someone else who's talking at him on the left in the next panel, and then Ray is responding on the third panel, and then I realize, oh no, that's Ray in all three panels. It's just that Cecilia is swinging the quote camera all the way around so that Ray is on the right looking left, then he's on the left looking right, and then he's on the right looking left again, which your mileage may vary, I find a little confusing, particularly since the artist, I think definitely on cue from the script, is not showing us who Ray's talking to on purpose.
And also the second panel, it's less clear that it's Ray, the others.
Yes, because of how it's cropped. You don't see the signature Ray hairstyle with the widow's peak and then the sideburns because of how the shadow is and how the crop is. And you don't see the shoulder pads or the stitching on his sweater. So there are like five different visual cues that could help reinforce that. No, this actually is Ray. It's just the camera's now on the other side of him. So he appears to be looking in the opposite direction, breaking the 180 degree rule, which really means that the camera has crossed the 180 degree line. Go Google it. Anyway, so I turn the page. And there are two pages of Ray talking to himself or talking to someone that we don't see. And I think Cecilia's art, there's something about his faces, His eyes, all of the eyes he draws across these two issues are a little too small. And I think his sort of full body anatomy in action choreography needs a little work. But right here, these two pages of Ray just thinking and talking and being concerned, there's a lot of nice work here.
Do you want to know what I think looking at these pages?
I do.
And so I did a search for Javier Cecilia, and the only credited comic book art that I can find for him are these issues. So I think these were very, assuming that he's not just changed his name, I think these probably were his first published issues and potentially his last. And sometimes you find from new artists that they lean very heavily on the sort of photo reference and to the degree of almost like sort of tracing it. And I think what he's doing with a lot of these panels, particularly on these pages, is taking photo reference and trying to recreate that, you know, relatively faithfully, which is why you're getting sort of interesting and in some degree sort of lifelike expressions. And, you know, it's not just the same rote comic book face over and over again. I think he's taken lots of photos of probably his own face or, you know, some model's face and sort of, you know, all sorts of different angles and expressions to create some interest around these multiple panels, which are just, you know, face, someone talking. So I think this is what's happening here.
Yes, that is a reasonable guess that I could get behind. The unsung hero of such an exercise would be the model. Whether that's the artist themselves, they hand their camera to someone and say, take some pictures of me, or the artist grabs someone and says, hey, can you sit like this and look like this and look like this and put your hand behind your head? I'm going to take some photos. You have to coax a performance out of your friend, the model. And I don't mean like a model you pay this, you know, like your friend you just take photos of for 10 minutes. All right. So then we get our first scene where one of the Joes is on R&R, and it turns out to be Colton himself along with Sparks. And on the one hand, on the second page of them in his home, and I always forget that Colton is with and lives with G.I. Jane, because she's barely showed up in all these issues with Colton, which is not a criticism. But Colton sits down and immediately starts sort of laying guilt on himself to Sparks. And I thought, is this warranted? I mean, Colton's a general, right? And Sparks is a lieutenant or a specialist. And I guess they're sort of kind of family, because Jane says, you know, you're practically family. Come inside, take a load off. And Colton immediately sits down and says, oh man, I botched that job. Oh man, so many people are dead. Oh man, The Rock is in terrible shape. Oh man, the president. Oh man, oh man. And I like that Sparks says, no, 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 sir. Here's a way to think about it. On the other hand, I can't imagine a lot of G.I. Joe writers having someone in charge like Hawk or Colton say to someone, the chain of command works both ways. You don't lay this on a lower ranking character. So I do think Colton just needs to let it out. And maybe he and Sparks have a really great relationship because they're always stuck back at base. And Colton turns to Sparks and says, yes, radio stalker, and have him do the thing. But this also struck me as a little odd.
Yeah.
Okay. And then we get this scene where Duke is slamming Ray against a brick wall in St. Louis. And this is where Cecilia's art, I think, starts to reveal itself as less comfortable in the action kinetic mold of comics. You know, some good facial expressions, but also just sort of some weird poses and compositions. But on the second page of this scene, which is actually page 9 of this story, Ray screams at Duke all of this top secret information about being duped and the president and people who were killed and Cobra. And They are on a crowded sidewalk next to a cafe, and the previous page shows a dozen civilians just walking around near them. And as I read this, I thought, no, 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 don't yell that out loud in public. That's all top secret. This is really weird. And also in the three pages earlier, Colton is like, we're not going to talk about this because that this went to the highest level to the White House is embarrassing. Like, we can't let this out.
Except, yeah, if you're shouting it in the middle of the street.
Yes.
Mind you, Ray, I don't think he's quite of sound mind at this stage. So who knows?
Okay, if that's the case, then Mike O'Sullivan needs to sort of run with it and have Duke clamp his hand over Ray's mouth and throw him into an alley and say, keep quiet, you nut.
Yeah.
And the fact that Duke doesn't do that to me suggests that the illogic of Ray's action here has sort of passed by O'Sullivan as writer, because Ray doesn't realize it's the wrong thing to do and Duke doesn't try and stop it.
Yeah. And who knows what was in the original script? It might be the sort of more crowded, you know, it might be that the more crowded streets with the background characters and stuff was added as some artistic flair. Hard to know.
Oh yeah. Yeah. The script may not technically call for that. In which case I sure wish the editor, oh wait, that's also the writer.
The same person.
Had called for a change, but you know, maybe these two issues were done in a hurry or, you know, maybe Hasbro. Okay. So then on the next page, Ray says, I don't know a lot about my past. Duke, you're a spy. Can you figure out my past or help me figure out my past? And then Duke says, yes, so I can keep an eye on you. And I thought, I don't know. This is very comic booky. It's very like TV showy. It's very movie. Like, I think Duke would just be so angry and so distrustful that he would say no. And I like the logic of, because it motivates a story. I like the mechanics of Duke saying yes, right? But it's not to help you. It's to keep an eye on you, to make sure you don't step out of line. Because when you do, I want to be the one to take you down. I thought, cool. But I also thought, no, man, Ray's so messed up. I feel like you can't come back from that. And then there's no story. Then the next issue and a half don't happen. And the next issue and a half really need to happen for the series to keep going so that Ray can either become the villain he was always meant to be or can get taken off the board and not be a dangling thread. But I got to that and I thought, I don't know. So, Mark, how do you feel about this scene?
I'm willing to go with it. I'm willing to go with this one.
Okay.
I'll let it play out. We'll see what, you know, how it all resolves when we get to the end of it.
Okay.
So there's the scene with Kamakura, which I think we've probably covered. They're then back at the Rock Duke and Ray. Lady J, before she died, was doing some investigation, and they've got a box that's been taped up with her hard work. It says something on the tape. It was frustrating that I couldn't figure out what the red tape on that box actually says.
Is that one of these Javier Cecilia original inked pages on Comic Art Fans posted by the inker Nick Nix that you can look at up close without the word balloons in the way? I'm scrolling down right now. No, I don't think so. There are only 9 pages on Nick Nix's Comic Art Fans. Okay, and it's none of these. Is it just like the word secret? Because we can see an E.
I can see E N T I A, the middle panel. I'm lost. I can't figure it out.
Confidential. That's it.
Yes. Yeah, that would work.
Okay. Very good. Good job, Tim. So what this scene did for me, and you've referred a little bit to this scene at the Rock with Ray and Duke opening up this box, has, just on these 2 pages, I know the scene is 3 pages long, it has 3 footnotes that all refer to previous story arcs. Footnotes are always welcome because, you know, this is an old Jim Shooter adage, or this is an old Stan Lee adage. You know, every issue is someone's first issue, even an epilogue issue for the previous 19. And you want to make things clear, and footnotes are not, you know, so graphically intrusive that they like ruin this flow or they're ugly. I'm generally very happy to see footnotes, but here they represent a lot of exposition where I feel like Duke and Ray are kind of talking to me, the reader, not each other, about stuff that I should remember or stuff right between the scenes of things that I should remember.
Remember that time we first saw General Ray? He was in the middle of this big fight, confrontation between Ray and Major Bloods with Armada.
Yeah, yeah.
You remember that? That was the first time we saw him, and that happened in G.I. Joe Union, the Snake Trade paperback. But we didn't know anything about him before then.
Okay, so here's what I'm getting to. All other things being equal, I'm okay with footnotes. I love footnotes. Part of why I love footnotes is that, if I'm remembering correctly, my first issue of G.I. Joe, issue 90, has 5 or 6 footnotes in it, which was a little unusual for G.I. Joe, and issue 90 is a little bit of a transition issue. But what was so cool about it is that it refers to all these bonkers things that had happened previously, just a few issues earlier and many issues earlier. And it gave a little bit of a roadmap to my brother and I, what issues we wanted to track down first, because there weren't graphic novels available with 10 or 20 issues at a time. And it's like, okay, wait, they're talking about Serpentor's death? Let's get that issue, right? Etc. So that's fun. Now, as a contrast, at the same time, this is 2006, at the same time, between 2000, 2001, and I don't remember when the rule was rescinded, but let's say 2005 or 6, Marvel Comics was undergoing a big creative renaissance, a big creative upheaval, let's say renaissance, because the new person in charge, Bill Gemmis, and the new editor-in-chief, Joe Quesada, came in to change a bunch of stuff and shake things up. And Gemmis had a couple rules for Marvel in the early 2000s, one of which was no flashbacks, because Marvel was doing so much, Marvel was doing so much navel-gazing for the previous 30 years, where like every 5 pages in X-Men, someone's like, oh man, remember when? It's like, remember when, you know, so-and-so kidnapped Iceman, and there'd be like 2 panels showing you it. Or like, remember when Jean became that crazy angry space god and she killed that planet? It's like, yes, everyone knows that famous story from the early 80s. You don't have to show it. So Gemmis had a rule, no flashbacks and no footnotes. And I remember a couple times during that span, someone would refer to something that had happened, and I would sort of look an inch over or down to see the footnote, and it wasn't there. And it does make the reading experience a little smoother, a little faster. But again, here in this G.I. Joe scene, it feels conspicuous that Mike O'Sullivan is like definitely just arranging all of the sort of like previous stories on the mantle, you know, over your fireplace. But the other thing that bums me out about these is the second of the 3 footnotes, which to me is just a lettering mistake. And I don't think I've been hard on relatively new letterer Brian J. Crowley in our previous episodes, but some of his lettering in G.I. Joe America's Elite is not good. And I have 2 quick examples. One is here on page 9. There are 2 cases here where a word balloon or a caption box with a footnote is touching the right edge of the page, where the actual like blade trimmed the paper. And letterers are supposed to not go too close to the edge of a page. Like there's like an imaginary box, and they're not supposed to get too close to the page in case a page gets trimmed a little bit more than it should, which happens much less in the last 20 years than it did in the previous, you know, 70, because printing and publishing is a lot better. But also because you're not entirely sure when a page is actually that you think is on the right side is going to get printed as a left side page because of how the ads are arranged. Or just because a page is on the right side doesn't mean it's going to show up on the left side in the graphic novel collection because you remove the ads. And so on this same page, right, where Duke and Ray are talking, two panels lower than this CGI Joe Union of the Snake trade paperback caption box that is cut off on the right side. Two panels down, all the way on the left, Duke has a word balloon where he says, "I'm hoping that we can find some detail," right? And the word, the D of the word detail, that's way too close to the left side of the page. And if you're reading this in a graphic novel, that D is very hard, that word is very hard for you to see. So for that reason, and also back on page six, panel five, okay, when Jane, the panel below Colton kissing G.I. Jane, panel five, she says, "Well, no matter, you're practically family," right? "Well, no matter, it's way too high. I need some space." So they pointed out a few issues ago in the letters page or in the Devil's Due news page, there were some new hires at Devil's Due, and one of them is Brian J. Crowley.
All right.
And I'm seeing some amateur letterer mistakes in not just these issues, but some previous ones that I haven't called out. And, you know, just because you can sit at a computer and in Photoshop make ellipses and like type words, letterers are designers, they're graphic designers. So letterers should have some design background. And maybe Crowley is just like, he had like an hour to letter the whole book and this was the best he could do. Maybe it's not his fault, but don't love lettering in these issues.
Yeah, that box, the CGI Joe Union of the Snake trade paperback on your copy, have you lost any of the letters with the trim?
No, but the word the G.I. Joe Union of the E is the E is at the edge of the page.
Yeah, I've got my bound collection and they do a little bit of extra trim when they bind it just to make sure that all of the pages are aligned and you don't have pages sort of sticking out at the edges. And with that trim, I did notice that on the odd occasion you're missing, you know, an extra millimeter or whatever, which is losing some of the lettering. So on my copy, I've only got the T of the.
Oh, wow. Back on page nine, that's the page where I was pointing out that Ray is screaming all this top secret information at Duke. On the last panel of that page, Ray's word balloon, and the holes that are in the memories of my life, two of those words are touching the edge of the page. So there's another example that those need to get pulled in. And, you know, the artist is a part of the equation. If the artist isn't leaving enough negative space, enough neutral space for the letterer, it's very hard for the letterer. And every letterer in comics has stories of artists who are packing their panels too tight or having the cameras in too close around, you know, faces or heads. And there are all these rules about lettering, about not covering certain things, not cutting certain things in half, not crossing certain things. And you have to lead the artist's eye around. So it's a dance between the artist and, you know, the writer who may be writing too much dialogue.
Yep. Okay. So there's Duke is looking at a piece of corrugated iron and, it's a file. And they figure out that there's a James Nurse. And when they look in the data desk, Xandar, his file crops up, which very nicely is actually included as the full file at the back of the book, which is a nice bit of synchronicity. And so they head on out to the Everglades to try and track him down. But before we get there, we check in with Scarlet. And again, as another callback, they point out that Scarlet's father is in a wheelchair, which is something that is a plot point from... Actually, did they don't have a call-out box, do I? For some reason, I imagine they did.
There's no footnote there. No, because I couldn't remember when it happened.
So it's her father's in a wheelchair, which is something that is referred to in the Scarlet Declassified story, which is also written by Mike O'Sullivan.
Okay, so the scene ends, the issue ends with Duke and Ray fighting some dreadnoughts in the Florida Everglades, and Zanya, Zartan, and Xandar show up above everyone, and Duke and Ray say, we just want to talk. We don't want to fight. And I thought this was great. I thought this the writing here was great, where Zartan is reminded that previously Xandar trespassed against him. And so Zartan says, it seems the misdeeds of my siblings are causing you as much trouble as they have me, Joes. Serana stole my tech for Cobra Commander. That ticks me off. I'm paraphrasing. And now you're reminding me that Xandar was part of this plot at the end of the previous series. And Zartan shoves Xandar off of this sort of high like swing where they're looking down on the Joes and the other Dreadnoughts. And Zartan says, Zarana made her own bet, Xandar. She will face the repercussions without my help. James Nurs was something you enacted on your own. You'll deal with the fallout without me as well. And then you turn to the last page of the issue, and we're looking up past Duke and Ray at the ready, fists at the ready. Xandar has got two knives drawn at the ready. There's a fire behind them because Torch was involved in the fight earlier. And Zartan says, short of killing him, my brother is yours, Joes. A warning, though, I doubt it'll offer you much without a fight. I thought, what a great bit of character work on Zartan that manages to organically remind me of something that had happened previously with both Zarana and with Xandar. It's very much in character with Zartan. It is a great example of the sort of Joe and Cobra, or Joe and, you know, partially affiliated bad guy, like the Dreadnoughts in this case, sometimes either working together or having sort of a truce because there's a bigger fish to fry, or it's like, no, I actually don't want this fight, but you can try to ask my evil brother some questions. And lastly, it's just a great ending to an issue. And writing endings to stories, writing endings to issues, those are always hard. Just writing endings, that's hard. And a lot of comics have okay endings or pretty good endings. And this as both a setup for the next issue, part two, and also for ending on some tension, like a promise of, you know, fight, continuing the sort of emotional battle that's happening here, where we feel sympathetic to Zartan, who's been betrayed by his brother and his sister, who doesn't want to help the Joes, but recognizes that they're, you know, honorable or worthy. I thought these last two pages, in terms of writing, great.
Cool. So the next issue picks right up where we left off with the promise of a fight, and panel one is a punch to the face with some blurry colors suggesting motion, which, if I remember correctly, is something that you're not particularly keen on, Tim.
I like speed lines. I think on this first page, all three panels where the black ink of the arm or leg that's moving fast is knocked back as like murky green, doesn't make it, the speed lines are already doing the work that it's fast. That's in the inking. The colorist who's taking the black out of it just makes it look invisible.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
Like that, he's activating a power.
Yeah. That leg looks like an activated invisible leg power, not a moving, quick, kicking leg.
Right.
So Xandar is kind of on the receiving end of Ray and Duke. So he gets in a couple of good ones. He stabs Ray right in the old leg and maybe kicks him in the nuts. So but they do eventually get the better of him. Quite a cool action sequence, really. And then with him on the ropes, essentially they force him into telling him what he knows, somewhat reluctantly, I think it's fair to say. He doesn't give an awful lot away. Basically, yeah, the telling them almost what they knew already, that James Nurs was this persona when he worked for the Coil. He gave Cobra something, and they have to go and talk to Scott Stevens, the psychologist, which is the big reveal. And it's some good kind of expressions and emotion, you know, emoting here, I suppose, from the artist. General Ray's reaction, what? It's sort of very quiet, you know, smaller lettering, suggesting that he's saying it more quietly, and you know, a good sort of slightly shocked expression, very much selling the emotion.
In terms of character motivation, a couple panels later, when Duke and Ray are going to leave, and they leave, Ray says, "We're done here." And Xandar from behind them screams, "This isn't over! You both made a big mistake coming here and making a fool!" And then Duke interrupts and says, "I wouldn't go starting any more trouble with anyone, Xandar. I think you've got enough problems at home." And we cut back to Zartan, who's looking down with his arms folded. And I thought, is that the character beat that Xandar would have here, where he's so embarrassed and so angry that he yells at them? Like, that's a good setup for Duke to then have that response. But I sort of hoped that Xandar would be cooler than that, and that he, rather than having this sort of embarrassing, immature outburst, he would maybe just, okay, here's a different take on it. Road Pig leans over to him and says, "You gonna let them get away with that, Xandar?" And Xandar whispers, "I'll see them again." And I guess we've established that Xandar is the younger sibling from, you know, when the three Z siblings were kids and everyone overlooked them. And, you know, his brother is a better villain, and his sister is a better villain, and his niece is a better villain. But I thought, Xandar, don't put your, you know, self-respect out there so much. Just like, be cool. You know?
Be cool, Xandar. Next up, we've got a scene checking in with Spirit, who's at the rock looking at pictures of his family on a monitor. And I didn't entirely get this scene, because he says that he's not privy to where his family are because they were relocated within protective services. Does that make sense to you? I mean, surely if they're put in protective services to protect them from Cobra because he's in G.I. Joe and they're the reason they need to be protected, you'd think, wouldn't he still be able to see them? And you know, all of the other Joes can see their families, so what's so different?
Yeah. I think because...
I mean, they were specifically threatened with that image on Cobra Commander's computer, which hasn't been completely explained, and maybe that's what this is trying to do, but doesn't quite explain it for me.
It did seem like a bigger sort of leap, but, you know, I haven't had my family threatened, and I've never used protective services or, you know, witness protection. So I think Mike O'Sullivan may be taking sort of a bigger leap here because he's only got, you know, 22 pages to play with. But yes, it did jump out at me as a lot, and maybe sort of artificially inflating Spirit's loss here, that, you know, he's been injured by a Cobra Commander and tortured, and his family's gone, not dead, just gone. But then for him to forgive Hawk, or to say, no, it's not your fault, there's only one person I blame for this, then the stakes are higher, so that turn of his can be that much more magnanimous.
And it's a good point as well that, I guess, you know, if you'd read that Hunt for Cobra Commander and, you know, everything that happened to Spirit, I guess he'd have every reason to be angry with Hawk for what he's gone through. So I guess that's just clarifying that idea that there's no animosity there, that it's directed in the right direction towards Cobra, the baddies. So more dark panels with General Ray's facial close-ups. I guess it's very much echoing the setup in the previous issue, where there was lots of you know, dark backgrounds, intense close-ups on Ray's face as they are confronting this psychiatrist who we don't actually see in this sequence until quite close towards the end. He's able to whisper or say this wake word, Draculia. Is there a meaning to that, do you think? Draculia?
Draculia. Isn't one of the Serpentor DNA...
Vlad the Impaler. Oh, Vlad the Impaler. It's a Roman name for Vlad the Impaler. That's a good deep cut there.
Because what was the previous one? He said Napoleon, right? In the previous issue? Someone said that over the phone?
Mm, right. Well remembered, Tim. Yeah, when they're on the phone. Yes, absolutely. So there must be various subliminal words that have been sort of programmed. And this one is sort of to wake him up and sort of make him compliant and make him turn on Duke, which he does for at least for a little while. And it's only when we see who's behind it, and we, you know, might guess that it's Crystal Ball, given his moustache and his hairstyle.
Yes, I thought, oh, I bet that's Crystal Ball. And then later, Ray says, who are you? And Crystal Ball says, I'm Crystal Ball.
And just before Ray offs Duke, Crystal Ball very kindly gives us a nice bit of exposition explaining everything, really, all about how it came about, that he / Serpentor is an amalgam of the greatest warriors of recorded history, including Vlad the Impaler, as you suggest, and really just laying out the entire detail of the history of Serpentor, the history of the clones, recapping where we've seen Serpentor and Rey through the last however many issues it is, or, you know, 40 odd issues. How did the exposition and joining all of these dots of this long seeded tale connect for you, Tim?
You know, it goes both ways. I'm always excited to see a dense 9-panel grid in a comics page where either a bunch is happening or, you know, one person's talking, as we saw earlier in this story arc, you know, 9-panel grid of Ray just talking. And, you know, if every issue is someone's first issue, or if someone is a lapsed reader and has been keeping up with Devil's Due or the Joe Casey Devil's Due, but hadn't reread the Marvel stuff in 10 years, this is fun and helpful. But it does feel conspicuous. And it's someone talking for 3 pages straight. And, you know, this is an action comic. And, you know, I compare this to, you know, what's a long flashback? This is not fair. What's a long flashback from the Larry Hama G.I. Joe? Oh, issue 26. You know, there's some multiple page flashback scenes in that. It's not fair because that's, you know, the big reveal of the most favorite character, and it's Vietnam, which is, you know, really heavy, and it's the loss of family, you know, at the airport and injury, it's origin stuff, but you know, those are really compelling scenes. And I think what's most interesting here is that Mike O'Sullivan has Crystal Ball and Javier Cecilia, for that matter, as penciler, very explicitly weaving together Marvel and Devil's Due story. And of course, the Devil's Due G.I. Joe comics have been a continuation of the Marvel run. But we know, and we've heard from Blaylock, that it was also kind of a new continuity because it pulled in elements from the cartoon and had a different sensibility than the Marvel run. And so to see it all happen together on one page was striking. Also, I'm shifting gears here slightly, to see Javier Cecilia, seemingly a very new comics artist with these two issues, on this first page of flashbacks, redrawing like a Rod Wiggum panel or a Mike Zeck cover of Destro and Mindbender with a mummy. I think this is a Ron Wagner panel of Serpentor atop a hiss, a Ron Wagner panel of Serpentor actually getting hit by the arrow from G.I. Joe 75. The comparison is a little less flattering, where you have a very new artist drawing scenes that directly correspond to, even though they were young artists, they had more comics drawing experience by the time they were doing G.I. Joe. I also think the composition of the big half splash with Crystal Ball standing and the 13 heads behind him, the heads and shoulders, the DNA matrix of Serpentor, the Conquerors, and also Storm Shadow. I think the weakness of that composition, how the heads feel a little haphazardly arranged, is pretty telling that Javier Cecilia is doing some things well in these two issues of G.I. Joe, and other things are really not his strength. Back to you.
Yeah, so after the reveal, Ray is pointing his gun at Duke and he's told to do it. Do it! Do it! And he doesn't. Do it now, Serpentor! That was me trying to do an evil emperor rather than a Cobra Commander, as it kind of turned out. My name is not Serpentor. My name is Philip Ray. And he doesn't do it. He doesn't kill Duke, and he turns on Crystal Ball. And then we cut to Crystal Ball on a, what do you call it, a gurney? Being loaded into the back of like an ambulance, and it looks like,
yeah,
that might be Falcon and Law next to
I thought it was Footloose. I think I see a mustache, and I don't see the what's the sort of necktie for a Green Beret?
Right. Yeah.
It's not a necktie, but it's something tied around his neck. Yeah. Sorry, Carson.
Hard to say. But yeah, a couple of Joes there. Putting him in into the back of a vehicle. And then we have this finale with this reconciliation between Duke and Ray. He says that I should turn you in. Serpentor has done unmeasurable damage, possesses too serious a threat. You should be put down like a rabid dog to prevent what you could become. But I can't deny that as Philip Ray, you have shown great altruism in your defense of democracy. I'll consult with Colton about all of this, but for now, I'm willing to leave you as Ray. But I see even a trace of Serpentor, I will take you out permanently. So, strong feelings there.
I suspect that this falls sort of the same way that the first part of this bookend in the previous issue, where Ray says, Duke, I need your help, figure out my past. And I said, I don't know about this. And you said, I'm willing to go with it. So this ending, I thought, I don't know about this. And can I guess, Mark, that your response is, I'm willing to go with it.
Kind of willing to go with it, but also how is that going to play out? He's going to talk to Colton about it, but given everything that's happened, given that, you know, underneath it all, he's Serpentor. Given that he's not really a proper general, despite his DNA, that he's been installed in this identity by the jugglers with their own nefarious actions, what does that actually mean for Ray in terms of his place in G.I. Joe, the military, wider society? You know, what do you do with a problem like General Ray? I don't know. What could they do with him, you know, that doesn't underestimate the threat, doesn't put him in, you know, in a particular, in a place of power, doesn't seem unduly harsh or authoritarian in terms of the punishments?
So, okay.
I don't know if there's going to be an outcome that would feel completely satisfying with all of these different elements of that threat, but also the heroism that Ray has also shown, and the willingness to, you know, be good.
I think that this is Mike O'Sullivan assuming that, you know, Blaylock or Mike O'Sullivan as editor hasn't decided for the next writer who's taking over, that something specific does have to happen with Ray. It's possible that Mike O'Sullivan is saying, okay, I've capped Ray's story. He gets a satisfying ending. He's a dupe or he's a villain, but he's redeemed himself. Someone can bring him out of storage if they want to, but for now he's sort of out of the picture because he needs to be out of the picture. And the next writer could have him at the Rock giving consultations for two panels every other issue. It's like, well, Ray, what do you think? What would Cobra be doing now? You've got Serpentor rattling around in your head. Or maybe there needs to be a little bit more like of an epilogue note in another issue or two where someone like Shipwreck or Roadblock can walk by Ray in the hallway and turn away and, you know, I don't trust you. You betrayed us. So this either could continue a little bit. This could continue a lot where there's not a power struggle, but sort of a very... A real acknowledgement that Ray is in the picture and has something to offer, but is conflicted and creates conflicting feelings. Or it's like, no, the next writer just may not use him for 5 or 10 or 1,000 issues, and this is the last we see of Ray, and that's sort of enough. I think this is intended to do whatever of those three needs to happen. For my part, I do think that the beats of this story were all good, that, you know, Ray is about to kill Duke, but he doesn't, and he's a hero after all, and that he gets redeemed. That feels a very Larry Hama thing. I'm not saying Mike O'Sullivan did it because that's what Hama would have done it, but it reminds me of something that would happen in the Larry Hama G.I. Joe, where Ray doesn't go to jail. He doesn't get shot. He doesn't get kidnapped by Cobra and they try to turn him again. He doesn't turn back to Cobra himself after thinking about it. No, he just stays with the Joes. So I like that it's happening. I do think that this dialogue on the final page where Duke says, well, you are responsible for a lot of death and you are a clone and you are a Serpentor and you were brainwashed and you're not a real person, but you are a general and you can hang out with us, but I'm going to talk to Hawk about it, or Colton, I forget. Colton, I think that's just sort of too compacted, and that's something that happens sometimes on the final page of a comic, you know, something that I want to breathe more over three pages or two issues gets crunched because maybe it has to. And also it's not it's not the most action-packed thing. They're just talking outside of a warehouse. They're talking at a parking garage overlooking a... Anyway, so... Okay, because I thought, no. Don't let him back into base. Don't let him be part of the command structure, even as just a consultant. That's too much. And then I thought, okay, I would be fine with this if some of Duke's dialogue was like, we'll have Lifeline check you out. Like, we're going to have Lifeline and Psych out and G.I. Jane, because she's a nurse, right? I know she fires lasers from Manhattan, but in the 60s, she was a nurse. We're going to have Lifeline and Stretcher and Psych out, like, look over you, or we're going to put you under their care. And if you earn your place, I just need one more sentence for this to work for me, as opposed to, yes, let me check with Colton, I might shoot you. but then I realized, as sort of rushed and unrealistic as it is, Larry Hama does this kind of thing, you know, how Throwdown joins the Joes. It's like, oh, my son can be a Joe now, even though the generations may not line up, or Don Marino becomes a Joe and she was a Cobra. And I know that those two characters are particularly loaded because they're in the legacy of Snake Eyes and, you know, the brainwave scanner.
Without sort of wanting to crowd your thought there, but you've got things like Sightline, who has that arc where he loses his leg and is given a prosthetic leg, and it's like, now I've got this amazing prosthetic leg, you know, I can still be a Joe and will never be seen again. You know, that storyline's not necessarily followed up, and That's almost like how, as you say, it's how it's left here, that there's room to maybe do something with it, but also there's room to maybe just never feature Ray again. And I genuinely can't remember if he does appear after this issue or not. But what this is doing is that Ray element was such a mystery and sort of unresolved element of the Jawa and era and flowing into the Joe Casey era, that it needed to have some sort of story really to do it justice and sort of just resolve all of those dangling threads and explain how it all fitted together. And it has done that nicely in terms of we've had that Ray arc resolved. We know who he is, where he's come from, you know, what some of those mysteries about the Juggler's connections to Serpentor, etc. It's all sort of, you know, coalesced, and that means that potentially, you know, we can then move on with issue 21 with almost a fresh start, without having to worry about the baggage of all of this stuff hanging over it, because the key mysteries of the previous 30 odd issues are kind of resolved.
Yeah. Okay, I'm gonna do two art criticisms. On this final page, in the third panel, Duke is silent, and the way that the shadow is on his hair and his head and his chest, you don't see any of his blonde hair. And I think this does sort of work, because he's standing in a parking garage and there's a light behind him and he's sort of stepping forward, and I think he is sort of stepping into the light, and then you see him, you know, I should turn you in. You see him without shadow. So I think logically the light does work. But I always have a little sort of visual confusion when, you know, like an artist who's not... I looked at this panel and I said, who's that? That's basically what happened. I looked at this panel and I said, who's that? Oh, right, it's Duke. And it's not that I need Duke to always have blonde hair and that Duke can't be in shadow, but just as a sort of a graphical representation of Duke, and a little confusion here. And then I want to go back a few pages to page 13, where Ray and Duke are fighting after the big reveal and Crystal Ball's exposition. So there's this panel, it says Elsewhere, and Duke and Ray are in an office and they're both full body. The poses are nice. Duke is, you know, ducking backwards to not get slashed by this knife, and both have pistols. And that's great. And Cecilia has chosen to draw this panel in 3-point perspective, which is pretty extreme. And I'm not quite sure what that does for us. Like, 3-point perspective is generally reserved for when you're looking up at things or when you're looking down at things that are otherwise in 2-point perspective. Think, you know, buildings. The sort of the scale of this is too wrong. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, look at this panel and just notice how exaggerated the background is, how like pinched it is. And it does add a little oomph to this moment of this Joe attacking another Joe. But it's sort of overdrawn in this perspective, and we don't ever see it again. So that's weird. I wanted to ask you, Mark, what you thought about this sort of, it's not even a subplot, sort of punchline, the poker scene, and then this punchline that Shipwreck and Covergirl are dating.
Yeah, I think the fact that I glossed over it as we were talking about the sort of the plot just now kind of is a little bit telling, in terms of it sort of breaks up this very sort of dramatic sequence with Ray, Crystal Ball, Duke, with this, you know, very visually different looking scene with the poker game, you know, different artist, you know, more cartoony, much more of a jokey, light-hearted moment, and then we're back to this very intense scene. So I don't know that they necessarily fit together very well and belong together particularly well, maybe the grouping is not completely satisfying. In terms of the relationship, you know, fine. Gather girl can go out with a shipwreck. That's all right. It's quite funny that they joke about him cutting his hair and getting rid of that long haired shipwreck look that had been introduced by Stefano Caselli for America's Elite, and he's got his top lip moustache back again before he had obviously lost that and had a slightly different look to him. So they're sort of I guess establishing more of the shipwreck look. The relationship, I don't know, has come out a little bit of nowhere. They are in that. Are in that special missions Brazil.
Oh yeah, this was my note, because when I read this, so we haven't.
That is April 2007.
Okay, so as I read this comic, as I read America's Elite 20, halfway through on the right side, there is a page with ads for the next issue of America's Elite, Dreadnoughts Declassified 3, Special Missions Brazil. And then a Special Missions collection. And it's got part of the cover to Special Missions Brazil, and it shows Cover Girl kicking someone and Shipwreck punching someone. And then I turn the page, and they're dating. And I thought, and you wouldn't experience this if you're reading the graphic novel of America's Elite. And I turn the page back, and I thought, oh, I wonder if this is referred to in Special Missions Brazil. Because two pages ago, they're on the cover to that special, and it's written by Sam Wells.
The main story in Special Missions Brazil is written by Sam Wells, but the backup story with Shipwreck and Cover Girl is written by Mike O'Sullivan.
Okay, great. So you're saying that, yes, this Special Missions issue does refer to...
Yeah, I think it must follow up on this sequence. It comes out in... It's cover dated April 2007, so it's a couple of months after... This one has come out.
Cool. I thought this scene was fun. You know, like I'm always into poker scenes in comics, because you know Marvel does them every 5 years with, you know, some Avengers and Spider-Man, and G.I. Joe's done them a couple times now, and the Devils Do Run. I thought that this scene was important because it seems to show that Shipwreck and Roadblock and some other Joes don't have families to go to,
right?
Or that when Colton says, get your head relaxed, do whatever you need to do, for these Joes, it's not going home, it's going to Vegas, it's blowing off steam. So that's fun. This like punchline where someone, we can't tell who, but I guess it's Roadblock and Rock and Roll and Clutch. Oh damn, no way, he gets the girl and the jackpot? That ain't right, man. That just ain't right. I feel like that's a little overstated. Like, no, Cover Girl can date who she wants if they want to date her. The joke is that they're shocked that she's sort of lowered herself, that, you know, he's so unappealing, or she's so particular.
Scruffy nerf herder, whatever. Yeah,
yeah, but I think the actual dialogue here is a little, it's not like male gazy, but I feel like it takes a little bit of Cover Girl's agency away, because like, oh, Shipwreck got the girl? Like, no, they are getting along and they're in a relationship, you know?
Yep. So all, before we just wrap up the thing, we've got a sneak peek at 21 at the very back. Which isn't necessarily something I'd always touch on, but you look at this and it was very much, whoa, those look like some nice pages. The I am looking forward to 21, because this art from Mike Baer is looking great. I don't know if you had the same reaction when you flicked to the end of the book, Tim.
Yes, on the top left, it says, an all-new direction for America's real heroes. And then on the top right, in a burst, it says, new writer Mark Powers, new penciler Mike Baer. And I think what they're trying to do is coax everyone to stay who's thinking of leaving because Joe Casey has left, or because they don't like the stories as much. And also to tease the return of Wraith. Also, we can see the Baroness, although we also can see the Baroness in that ad a couple pages earlier, the full page ad, which shows that I mentioned has the Special Missions Brazil bit. We see Baroness on the cover for 21. Yes, I thought this was a big splashy way. It shows most of three different pages of a jungle scene with some cobras that we don't recognize. Are those neovipers or something?
Well, we'll get into it when we get into it, Tim. I think
okay.
let's cover these issues and not right, get into okay. the next issue too much. So in a nutshell then, should we Joe color it? I like the fact that they've sort of, you know, tied up the previous plot points with Ray. It's a kind of nice change of scene and pace. I think the art is a mixed bag and not necessarily the most professional looking, and it does feel a little bit like a bit of a shopping list of these are the points we need to cover to make sure that all of the previous plot points are kind of touched on. We check in with all of the different Joes on the team and we tie up that Ray plot in a nice bow so we can have a fresh start for 21 and a new team. So I like these issues and I like that they exist and that the Ray storyline is kind of resolved, but in of themselves, I don't know it's the most exciting issues and necessarily beautifully illustrated issues. So I think I'll just go down the middle with a five. Not a regrettable read, but not necessarily one that I would leap back to immediately reread.
My reaction is the same. There's some good story and character work here. There are some good bits of action. There's a lot of checking in, and as I said at the beginning, it's an epilogue, and I think it's one either we needed or I wanted, but it's still a little thankless because you can't do a lot of exciting stuff necessarily in an epilogue, and it does feel a little bit like a lot of exposition. Yeah, a five.
Right. So I think we are done with America's Elite 19 and 20. Next time on Talking Joe Disavowed, we will continue our look back at the America's Elite era of G.I. Joe by looking at Devil's Due, America's Elite 21 through to 24, Sins of the Mother, four-parter with the new regular writing and art team. But we've got a choice to make. Do we look at that straight away, or do we take a little bit of a sideways track and look at maybe Scarlet Declassified, maybe Special Missions Antarctica? It would it's a natural sort of pause point to look at some of these other issues that have been coming out before we plunge into the next story arc.
Yes, I think we should read those other ones.
So let's do Scarlet Declassified first, and then maybe Special Missions Antarctica and Brazil, and then we can plunge into the ongoing story after that.
Yeah.
Cool. And then, as well as covering America's Elite, we'll also be covering A Real American Hero as it hits the stand. So A Real American Hero issue 301 will be in your local comic shop November 15th, 2003, and presumably monthly after that. Duke issue 1 of 5 is out December 27th. And Cobra Commander issue 1 of 5 is out January the 17th. Duke and Cobra Commander are at a price point of $4.99, which is a little bit eyebrow raising. But
wasn't Transformers number 1 at $4.99? Wasn't that a couple extra pages? I feel like that was longer than a regular
issue. Could be. But I don't know. This might be the new norm. We'll see. So, Tim, where can people find you when you are not talking to me about G.I. Joe comics?
video essays from my creative partners and I at our YouTube channel, Atomic Abe Productions. My brick and mortar comic book store in Somerville, Massachusetts is Hub Comics. And I write about G.I. Joe at arealamericanbook.com.
Excellent stuff. You can find more about Talking Joe at the usual places. TalkingJoe.co.uk is the website that has links to all of those places. You can find us on Facebook, on Twitter, on Instagram. We are also on Patreon at patreon.com/TalkingJoe. So a big thanks to all our backers: Richard, Sam, Jay, Bill, Christopher, Justin, Rob, Brian, and Shane, who are all getting early access to episodes as well as some exclusive content. And that is us done for now. But remember that
nobody beats Talking Joe, an international podcast.
Laters.